From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
It's Kellogg's for breakfast and a happy, happy day.
Today, the unusual story behind some of America's most popular cereals, like Kellogg's Corn Flakes and Rice Krispies. It involves the leadership of the Seventh-day Adventists and the early days of the wellness movement. We talk with Dr. Howard Markel, author of The Kellogg's, about the two brothers who co-created ready-to-eat breakfast cereals. The older brother, Dr. John Kellogg, founded a famous sanitarium, advocated a whole-grain vegetarian diet and probiotics.
He also was very chaste and reminded both his readers and his followers that sex for anything other than procreation really sapped the soul and sapped the spirit.
And David Bianculli reviews a new TV series adapted from a Stephen King novel. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of America's most popular breakfast cereals, like Corn Flakes and Rice Krispies, have a history that intersects with the Seventh-day Adventists, the early wellness movement, eugenics, sexual abstinence, and some innovative as well as some horrifying medical interventions. Not something you'd suspect from the popular jingles.
Kellogg's, good morning, the best to you each morning. K-E-L-L-O, double good Kellogg's, best to you.
My guest, Dr. Howard Markel, is the author of the new book, The Kellogg's, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. It's about Dr. John Kellogg and his younger brother, Will Kellogg. John, the doctor, was groomed to be a leader of the Seventh-day Adventists. In 1876, he became the director of their sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, which he turned into a world-famous medical center, spa, and grand hotel that attracted many celebrities. In 1921, his research on diet and digestion was nominated for a Nobel. As part of his dietary research, Dr. Kellogg and his brother created a new idea, ready-to-eat cereals like cornflakes. Will, who was the business innovator, turned those breakfast cereals into good-tasting, mass-produced, popular breakfasts marketed under the Kellogg brand. He founded the company in 1906. Although the two brothers worked together for a long time, they never got along, and their relationship ended with a series of lawsuits. Howard Markel directs the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan, where he's also a professor of pediatrics and communicable diseases. Dr. Howard Markel, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to write a book about the Kellogg brothers?
Oh, my. Well, there's a lot of reasons. But if you grew up in Michigan, as I did, you could not help but be aware of the Kelloggs. Every first grader, and I was one of them in 1966, would make a field trip to the Battle Creek factory where they made Kellogg's cornflakes. And we were all given a Tony the Tiger bowl, which I still own, and a little box of sugar frosted flakes, which was consumed long before we turned back to the suburbs of Detroit. And then, of course, there's the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, so you see the beneficence of the Kellogg family everywhere you turn. And when I was in medical school, I used to study in the library. And in between cramming the Krebs cycle or this physiological fact into my head, I would take a break. And I often paused at the section where Dr. Kellogg's books and magazines, his monthly magazine called Good Health, were stored. And I would take them down and read them and have fun with that. And I thought at that time, you know, somebody ought to write a book about these two fellas, never realizing it would be me.
It's funny, you know, breakfast cereals now are often considered basically sugar-coated vitamin pills because the fortification of vitamins is the nutrition and the sugar is what gets kids to eat it, but it's not very good for them. But breakfast cereals were originally part of a health craze that Dr. Kellogg created. Why was breakfast such a problem? Like if you were into health, like Dr. John Kellogg was, what were the problems with breakfast as he saw it?
Well, there were a number of issues. And yes, cornflakes, wheat flakes, flake cereal in general were invented to be easily digested by those with upset stomachs or what was then called dyspepsia, the great American stomach ache. And if you look at what people ate in America in the late 19th century or even the early 20th century, it was very heavy in animal fats, often cured meats, so they're very salty, a lot of sugar. You would have for breakfast potatoes that were fried in the congealed fat from the night before. A lot of alcohol and caffeine was consumed, a lot of carbohydrates. And making breakfast was an ordeal. So even if you made porridge or mush, these whole grains took hours to melt down and make into a mush or a soft form. And so these poor mothers were getting up very early, and they were probably taking care of all their children all night. They had to start a wood-burning fire, and so making breakfast was a great ordeal. But John Harvey Kellogg invented them for the invalided people who came to his Battle Creek sanitarium. It was his little brother, Will, who realized, you know, there are a lot more people who are healthy and just want a convenient, tasty breakfast than those who are ill and need an easily digestible breakfast. So he added a little sugar, a little salt to cornflakes, And it just took the world by storm in 1906 because you could simply pour breakfast out of a box. Even Dad could make breakfast now.
So it originally didn't have the title of like cornflakes or wheat flakes. What was the original flaked cereal that the Kellogg's invented called?
Well, their first cereal, basically Dr. Kellogg thought that if you dextrinize starch, what that meant is if you bake a grain for a long period of time at a high temperature, the starch molecules would break down into a simple sugar, dextrose. And that would be easily digested as soon as you start chewing because the salivary glands help break that down even further. And then, of course, as you go through the gastrointestinal tract, it easily breaks it down. So they first started serving double-baked Zweiback biscuits out of whole graham grain, which was whole wheat grain. And that's where the term graham cracker comes from, named for Sylvester Graham, who touted this in the 1860s. And one of his patients, supposedly, the story goes, broke her dentures on one of these hard Zweiback biscuits. And Dr. Kellogg did not want to have to pay for patients' dentures or dental artifices. So he decided to grind up the Zweiback into little crumbs. And that was their first cereal. He called it granola. It was nothing like granola today. And there was another product by a doctor in New York who was making granola. His name was Jackson, and he sued them. So they changed the name to Granose, which sounds very metabolic, that you're breaking down grain. But they weren't happy with that, Dr. Kellogg or his brother, and they thought there's got to be a better way to make cereal than just grinding up toasted bread, basically. And so they worked and they worked and they worked, and Dr. Kellogg tells a story that he had a dream of how to make flake cereal, and that's where the whole thing began. Will tells a different story that they just decided to roll it out very flat, and one day both Dr. Kellogg was called
away.
Roll
out like a dough?
Like a dough, yes. Roll it flat out like a dough because it was basically a boiled, at first wheat dough and then later a corn dough. But Dr. Kellogg was pulled away for surgery or something, and Will just put it aside. He didn't want to throw it out. He was very frugal, and he put it in a container. And what that led to is something called tempering the dough. It gets a little moldy, not too moldy that it tastes bad, but the air and the water content evens out across the entire dough. And when they did that and baked it, they came out with these perfect flakes. And so that's where it all began.
So these cereals started off as part of a larger health regimen that Dr. Kellogg prescribed. You credit him with coming up with the concept of wellness. He ran a sanitarium. So give us an overview of some of the beliefs that he had about wellness that actually became popular.
Well, Dr. Kellogg called it wellness. He called it biologic living. And he was really prescient about this. And don't forget, at the turn of the last century, most doctors were fixated on diseases, not preventing them, but treating them once they occurred. And back then, it was often once they occurred and were around for a long period of time, so they did their damage. Dr. Kellogg was all about preventing these diseases before they ever happened by living a healthy life. And that included exercise, a lot of vigorous physical activity, eating a grain and vegetable diet, avoiding animal fats or meats, or as he called it, flesh eating, avoiding that, no alcohol, no caffeine of any kind. He also was very chaste and reminded his both his readers and his followers that sex outside the marriage, of course, was not a good idea, but sex for anything other than procreation really sapped the soul and sapped the spirit. And of course, he was very much opposed to masturbation of any kind, something he wrote about extensively and called the solitary vice.
You say he was very chaste. He was totally abstinent. The way you describe it, he and his wife never even consummated their marriage. They had children, but that was through adoption. They slept in separate bedrooms. It sounds like he never had sex.
It sounds that way. Now, when John was in medical school at the Bellevue Hospital Medical College in 1874, he saw and treated a great many playboys and rakes who had syphilis and gonorrhea, and he wrote about it in his student notes. And these were not fun cases. I can tell you as an old sexually transmitted disease doctor, when you see these cases in full bloom, they are truly disgusting. I had the benefit in my practice of having antibiotics so they could be treated. But back in the 1870s, they were not only terrible infections, they often were deadly. And of course, they were contagious. So often these men who had other lives, frequented prostitutes or what have you, brought these infections home to their wives. So Kellogg may have been really freaked out by the perils of sex. I'm getting freaked out just telling you about it.
Well, let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Howard Markell. He's the author of the new book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. He's the director of the Center of the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan, where he's also a professor of pediatrics and communicable diseases. We'll be right back after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Howard Markell. He's the author of the new book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. And it's about the Kellogg brothers, one of whom was deep into health. He was a doctor and created a sanitarium where wellness was the thing. And his other brother was basically the marketing genius who popularized the flaked cereals that the brothers co-created, like cornflakes. And, of course, the other brother, Will Kellogg, created Kellogg's cereals. So another thing that he was in the forefront of was probiotics. He believed that Acidophilus,
yes,
which is one of the most common probiotics now, would help you maintain a healthy digestive system. And you describe his basement laboratory in which he studied fecal specimens under the microscope, comparing the fecal specimens of people who took Acidophilus with those who didn't. I mean, who else was doing that back in the turn of the century, in the turn of the 20th century?
There was a man named Henri Tissier at the Pasteur Laboratory in Paris. And Dr. Kellogg often traveled to Europe to learn new techniques and new ideas. You know, it's really funny. He started as a passionate believer in Seventh-day Adventism health reform, and he kept a lot of those ideas throughout his career. But as science and medicine progressed, he would read up on these. He would speak to the people who were making these discoveries, and he would shoehorn and shape these discoveries to his own worldview. So he worked with Dr. Tissier at the Pasteur Lab to study Acidophilus, and he found that people whose guts were populated with Acidophilus did far better in not having digestive diseases than those who did not. He also found that soy milk was a much better medium for the propagation of Acidophilus, and that babies who were fed soy milk Acidophilus did far better than those who were treated cow's milk, but not nearly as good as those who were treated breast milk, human breast milk.
Regularity was an obsession for Dr. Kellogg, and he had a lot of intestinal problems when he was a child.
He did. He did. As a child, he ate very badly. His favorite meal he lectured about was a braised oxtail in a greasy, fatty brown gravy. Even in his 70s or 80s, he would talk about those meals lovingly. And, you know, fried potatoes and flapjacks and bacon and things like that. So he ate a lot of not only fatty foods but constipating foods. He also ate a lot of candy. And he developed constipation. He developed hemorrhoids. He also developed a colitis that scarred his intestine. And so he knew what happened when you ate badly and you were constipated and not regular. He also like many doctors at that time, believed in a theory called auto-intoxication, where putrefying meat just stayed in your gut and gave off poisons that caused all sorts of problems from flatulence and dyspepsia to depression. So he was very aware of that, and he studied gorillas in zoos and realized that those gorillas had anywhere from 4 to 5 bowel movements a day, and they seemed to be quite happy. And so he prescribed his patients to do the same. And if you ate the diet that he recommended, as well as the frequent enemas and the yogurt and the soy milk and so on, you would indeed have frequent bowel movements.
So I want to give our listeners a heads up that we're just about to enter a part of the conversation which will take a turn into a couple of very disturbing surgical practices that Dr. John Kellogg used to discourage masturbation in teenagers and children. And so I just want to give a heads up to parents and to anyone else who feels that this might be too disturbing for them to listen to. If you fall into that category, you can come back in just a few minutes. He also believed in some things that seem pretty quacky to us now. Now, what are a couple of examples of those?
Well, let's begin with flake cereal. So they are more easily digested, but we now know that corn flakes or any flake cereal has something called a high glycemic index, which means you start digesting it as soon as you're chewing it, you start breaking it down. And so that will bounce your blood sugar all the way up, which then bounces your blood insulin level all the way up, and then both go down precipitously, and you're hungry 2 hours later. So, you know, long before lunch. So it's far better to eat a low glycemic index type of cereal like oatmeal because that keeps you full or feeling full for much longer. His views on masturbation were quite barbaric. And this was for boys and girls. And he would lecture to his patients who were parents, you know, you should look for signs of your teenager becoming sullen and grumpy and sleeping too much. And so he designed a whole series, a whole slew of treatments and procedures to prevent people from masturbating.
Some of them were surgical procedures that were barbaric.
Yes, putting carbolic acid on the penis or the clitoris of a young woman so that it actually caused a burning sensation. You would not want to masturbate or do anything for that matter in that region of your body. Similarly, he recommended circumcision for older boys or adults to prevent this because, of course, that too causes a great deal of pain. So the idea
and
was—
And he recommended that without any anesthetic.
No,
because he wanted
no.
the person getting the procedure to experience the pain. That was part of the point.
Yes.
So, again, you know, Dr. Kellogg had some really wonderful advanced thinking when it comes to health. He also had some really, you know, backwards, bad beliefs. And one of those beliefs was in eugenics. Do you want to describe his position on eugenics?
Yeah, that's the bloody stain on his white suit. He always wore white suits, by the way, so that you could see dirt very instantly and he could change. But that stain never really can be cleaned. So, you know, a great many Americans, particularly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Americans in the turn of the last century, were obsessed with the purity of the so-called white race. And eugenics was this pseudoscience, this pre-genetics, where certain traits, personality traits, behavioral traits would be passed down in a manner similar to blue eyes or brown eyes. Now, we know that's completely hogwash today, but a great many people believe that. Famous people like Teddy Roosevelt and John Harvey Kellogg and famous scientists at various universities and so on, because this pseudoscience fed their racist beliefs. It was also an era when a great many immigrants are coming to the United States, and they are extremely foreign to the people who are there, who are already living there. So East European Jews and Southern Italians and people from the Balkans and Greece and so on. And many white Americans felt that these people would never, could never assimilate into mainstream America and, in fact, would pollute what they called the protoplasm or the germplasm, the American gene pool. And so this was going on at all the best medical schools of the day, and there was research going on. And John Harvey got into this quite early. Now, he espoused more than eugenics, something that was called euthenics, which is a type of Lamarckism, if you will, that if you live a good, healthy life and you do the various things he prescribed, you could rid yourself of these negative traits, you know, being cheap or being shifty or being a criminal or what have you, and you could pass that on to your children. Now, very few eugenicists believed in this and used to make fun of John Harvey Kellogg behind his back. But they always took his phone calls because John Harvey Kellogg had a great deal of money, primarily from his cornflake dividends. And he funded a foundation for race betterment, and he founded three huge national conferences on race betterment. Two were in Battle Creek, and one was at the San Francisco World's Fair of 1915, where hundreds of stars in the eugenic firmament, even Booker T. Washington came to lecture and have a symposia on eugenics and euthenics. So it was a negative aspect of John Harvey Kellogg's life and ideology that is truly, truly problematic and disturbing.
My guest is Dr. Howard Markel, author of the new book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. After a break, we'll hear more surprising stories about the brothers who were behind some of America's most popular breakfast cereals. And David Bianculli will review Mr. Mercedes, a new TV adaptation of a Stephen King novel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Argus Fund, directed by Mark and Rachel Dibner, committed to helping NPR promote awareness and the discovery of diverse new music since 2011. And from Whole Foods Market, offering lunchbox staples geared to children, including sandwich and snack ideas using natural and organic ingredients. A variety of back-to-school items are available at Whole Foods Market. We believe in real food.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Howard Markel, author of the new book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. It's about John and Will Kellogg, who co-created ready-to-eat breakfast cereals, like cornflakes. John was a Seventh-day Adventist and physician who ran a sanitarium that pioneered the wellness movement. Ready-to-eat cereals were part of his recommended dietary regimen. Will Kellogg, the younger brother, was the industrial and marketing brains behind Kellogg cereals. Dr. Markel directs the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. So Battle Creek is famous for Kellogg's and for Post, another big breakfast cereal company, but it's also famous as, at the time, the home center, like the home base for the Seventh-day Adventists. And Dr. Kellogg, John Kellogg, was very close to co-founders of Seventh-day Adventism, Ellen and James White. And they saw him when he was a child as being a possible leader of the church in the future. So what was his relationship with the church?
Well, you're right. Battle Creek was basically the Vatican of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And John Harvey, even as a young boy and a young man, just exuded brilliance and was curious about everything. And so the Whites, who were the co-founders of the denomination, Ellen White was a prophetess, a self-proclaimed prophetess, and they realized this young man was quite special. So they groomed him. And a big part of Seventh-day Adventism and many Christian denominations in the mid-19th century was about health reform, about keeping your body clean and chaste and free of vice, and also dietary issues as prescribed in the Old Testament. And he later came to edit their magazine called The Health Reformer, which John Harvey later changed the name to Good Health because he realized that people don't like reform. They like to be healthy, but they don't want somebody telling them to reform. And so they realized that John Harvey could be the head of their health avenue, their health section of the denomination. Now, the Whites founded what became the Battle Creek Sanitarium, which was a world-famous medical spa, grand hotel, and medical center. But they called it the Western Health Reform Institute. It was basically a house where quacky doctors lectured about things and served bad food and people didn't come back. But they realized that John Harvey could be the new leader, but he had to get a good medical education. And when he came back to Battle Creek, he was tapped to take over the Western Health Reform Institute. And he said, I'll do so on one condition, that I get to run it, and I get to run it not only on religious principles, but on scientific principles, because he wanted desperately not only to be a good Seventh-day Adventist, but to be well-regarded in the medical profession. People from all around the world came to Battle Creek to heal.
Some famous people, too. Who were some of the famous people who came?
Well, he treated many presidents, including Warren Harding and William Taft. He treated William Jennings Bryan, the Democratic hopeful. He treated Eddie Cantor, the comedian. He treated Johnny Weissmuller, Tarzan, who would go into the dining room and do a Tarzan yell to begin the meal. He treated Amelia Earhart and Sojourner Truth he treated, and on and on and on.
So it's really interesting that cornflakes and all of the Kellogg cereals have a direct connection with the Seventh-day Adventists.
Yeah, it's really because that grain diet was very important to the Adventist. And of course, Dr. Kellogg found in his study of gastroenterology, which, you know, when you think, if anybody thinks about science at the turn of the last century, you think about germ theory and bacteriology and infectious diseases or the cleaning of the cities and water supply. But how we eat and digest our food was probably the second most important field in medicine. And so he studied this quite a bit.
What were some of the beliefs of Seventh-day Adventists?
Well, they're very similar to what I just described about John Harvey's wellness or biological living program. You were to have a chaste and spiritual life. You were to avoid worry. You were to avoid animal fat, flesh, meat at all costs, no drinking of alcohol, no caffeine, no smoking. And the grain and vegetable diet was the way to go. And, of course, this personal hygiene and keeping yourself clean externally and internally were some of their pronouncements.
And I think they also believe in this constant and ongoing battle between Satan and God, and that you really had to be careful to stay on the right side.
Yes, and so I'm skipping over the most important, you know, Adventism. So they believed in the imminent end of the world and the second coming of Jesus Christ, and that was taught very strictly. And young children were not often educated because, you know, in school and such, because the belief was, why put all that time and effort into educating children if the world's going to end anyway? And so there was a lot of fear and the concepts of the devil and terrible monsters that would take over the world at the second coming, and how only a very few, the most pious, would be elevated to heaven.
But it seems like Dr. Kellogg's work in trying to keep people more healthy and discover new things went against the idea that any day now the whole world can end and is likely to end. So what's the point?
That's a very good point, because he was all about life. There was a rupture between John Harvey Kellogg and the Whites that began probably
the Whites being the co-founders of the church.
Yes, Ellen and James White, the co-founders of the church. And the rupture probably began as soon as John took over the sanitarium. He was a very headstrong guy. He always knew he was right, even when he wasn't. Because he was so charismatic and brilliant, he often was right. But he did not want people who were not medically trained telling him how to run his hospital or his medical center. And he certainly didn't want people who were trying to run it from afar. You know, the Whites were often wintering in California. And of course, there were other elders of the Adventist church who looked at the profits that the sanitarium was making. Now, it all went back into the sanitarium, but they wanted some of that money for other Adventist projects and programs. And so John was very tight-fisted with the money he brought in and the ideas he was propagating. And eventually, there was a deep rupture and a whispering campaign that John was taken over by the devil that became a shouting campaign. And in 1905, he was excommunicated from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the very church he grew up in and was raised to become a leader in.
Well, let's take a short break here, and then we'll get back to cereal.
Okay.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Howard Markell. He directs the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan, and he's the author of the new book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Angie's List, who's committed to helping over 6 million members choose local service pros in their community. Over 20 years of members' reviews are available online. More at angieslist.com. Angie's List, home is where our heart is. And from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Howard Markell. He's the author of the new book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek, and it's about Dr. John Kellogg, who created this incredibly popular sanitarium and believed in wellness and the importance of wellness and was kind of like radical and advanced in a lot of his medical practices. And his brother, Will Kellogg, who was the kind of marketing genius behind Kellogg's cereals, which were originally created as a kind of health thing. Okay, so let's get back to cereal. Will was the marketing genius behind Kellogg's cereals. He was also in on the early recipes of them. And he had worked with his brother at the sanitarium as the business guy there, figuring out, you know, I guess all the accounting stuff and, you know, making the business end work. And he was very innovative on that front. But he was considered the dim brother when they were kids. He was 8 years younger than
Yes, and John, as the older brother, never missed an opportunity to pick on or humiliate his younger brother from childhood on. In his old age, Will said, what I remember most about my childhood is that I shared a bed with John and he would warm his cold feet on my back during the winter. And he would push him and make fun of him. And of course, when Will worked for him for almost 25 years as his administrative aide, John did all sorts of mean things. He had him run beside him as John rode his bike across the campus and Will had to take notes or dictation. When John went to the bathroom to have a bowel movement, he made Will come in and take notes so he wouldn't waste a moment, long before LBJ was doing that to his White House aides. And he didn't pay him well. He didn't treat him well. Yet Will was this business genius who knew how to run a very large organization, not only keep accounts, but come up with new methods to keep accounts in a better way. He was brilliant at human resources because you had thousands of employees doing all sorts of different tasks. You couldn't find a better tutorial for running an international corporation like the Kellogg Cereal Company than by running the Battle Creek Sanitarium for so many years. It's just that the psychic cost of being made fun of and treated as a lackey was very difficult for Will's psyche.
The two brothers, John and Will, fought to the end. And one of the things they fought about was the brand name of Kellogg.
Yeah, so as soon as poor Will became successful, and John Harvey sold him the rights and made a mint off of cornflake stock, he started making his own cereal and calling it Kellogg's. And of course, Will, by this time, had advertised to a fare-thee-well. This was beginning around 1909, and he was investing, you know, millions of dollars a year in ads. And he felt that another Kellogg-named product that was not nearly as tasty as his product would harm his company. And to some extent, to a large extent, he was right. So he sued John Harvey, and then John Harvey sued Will. And this lawsuit, it went for almost a decade, going all the way to the Michigan State Supreme Court. And the basic question was, who had the right to use the name Kellogg on a box of cereal? Now, going for John Harvey's case, you know, he was more famous. He was a world-famous doctor. He wrote books. He was a best-selling author. People came to see him for his digestive advice. He thought he was the guy. And Will said, well, no, wait a minute. Everybody who hears the name Kellogg's thinks of cornflakes now. And by that time, this is, you know, early 1920, they did. And the judges agreed with Will, and he won the case. And poor John Harvey had to pay all the legal costs and everything else. And he could only put his name in tiny writing on the bottom of the box for any cereal he created. And, of course, it was very easy to steal a patent for cereal, as the Kellogg's learned. All you have to do is change one little step, and then you can't really be sued by the person who holds the patent. So Will later made a mint off of brand cereals, even though that was truly John Harvey's creation. But the two, you know, there was a lot of bad blood between them. And then after the lawsuit, they rarely, if ever, spoke to one another again. Will made sure there was always a witness when they did speak to each other because he never knew what John Harvey would say about him.
So I have to tell you, when I was growing up, Battle Creek was this kind of mythic place for me because, you know, I'd have breakfast cereals for breakfast, and whether it was Post or Kellogg's, the address would be Battle Creek. And I would, like, stare at the cereal boxes when I had breakfast, and there wasn't much to read on them, so you're always seeing the name Battle Creek. And then there was always, like, a come on the boxes where, like, if you wrote to the address in Battle Creek, you'd get a free something or another, you know.
Right.
A souvenir of the cereal. And so it would all lead back to Battle Creek. And I had no idea what that was or what it meant, though it sounded like a really interesting name. Battle Creek.
Yeah.
Like, who knew what kind of battles went on there that helped produce these cereals?
Yeah.
Since you lived close to Battle Creek and actually took school trips there, was it a mythical place in your mind? You saw the reality of it.
Well, in 1966, it was, because Cereal City was in full operation. So
Cereal City, is that what it was called?
Yeah, that's what they called it, Cereal City. And, you know, if you were a Michigan boy, as I was, you took two big field trips. One was to the Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, Michigan, which also had a mythical sensibility to many children, but you took a trip to Battle Creek. So you went into this factory, which was pristine, and everyone was wearing white, and there was stainless steel devices all chugging and moving and doing stuff. And there were these conveyor belts. Literally, there were 5 miles of conveyor belts in the factory that went all the way from the granary, where they took raw corn or wheat or what have you. And you follow this path with a tour guide all the way to the boxing room where you had fresh boxes of cornflakes or sugar frosted flakes or what have you. And the smell was overpowering. I still remember that smell of toasted corn. And then they gave you a fresh box. And that fresh box was the best box of cereal I've ever had. And to some extent, I'm still searching for that wonderful fresh box of cereal.
Well, Howard Markel, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks so much, Terry. It's just been thrilling to have the opportunity to speak with you today.
Dr. Howard Markel is the author of the new book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. We were sad to learn today that singer Barbara Cook died this morning at the age of 89. She started her career on Broadway in the original productions of The Music Man, She Loves Me, and Candide. She went on to a second career as a concert and recording artist, performing American popular song. She was an extraordinary singer. We'll feature my interview with her on Friday. For now, let's hear her performing at Carnegie Hall in 2001 in her show Mostly Sondheim. This is the Sondheim song, Anyone Can Whistle.
Anyone can whistle, that's what they say, easy. Anyone can whistle, any old day, easy. It's all so simple. Relax, let go, let fly. So someone tell me, why can't I? I can dance a tango, I can read Greek easy. I can slay a dragon any old week easy. What's hard is simple, what's natural comes hard. Maybe you could show me how to let go, lower my guard, learn to be free. Maybe if you whistle for me.
Barbara Cook recorded in 2001. After we take a short break, David Bianculli will review Mr. Mercedes, the new TV adaptation of a Stephen King novel. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Tomorrow, a minor TV outlet presents a 10-part drama series that our TV critic David Bianculli says is good enough to be considered a major triumph. It's an adaptation of Stephen King's mystery novel, Mr. Mercedes, and comes from longtime TV writer-producer David E. Kelly. Here's David's review.
With cable networks and streaming services, a reputation can be made, or at least launched, by a single TV series or two if they're good enough to draw people in for the first time. HBO, with The Larry Sanders Show and The Sopranos. FX, with The Shield. AMC, with Mad Men and Breaking Bad. Netflix, with House of Cards and Orange is the New Black. Amazon, with Transparent and The Man in the High Castle. Hulu, with The Handmaid's Tale. And now comes a new drama series from what used to be called the DirecTV Audience Network, and now is owned by AT&T. This new series is called Mr. Mercedes, and it's billed as an AT&T original, available on DirecTV's Audience Network, and streaming on DirecTV Now and something called the U-verse. Wherever you can find it, it's worth finding. Even though those provider names may mean nothing to you, the names behind Mr. Mercedes should mean a lot. Its executive producers include Stephen King, who wrote the 2014 novel on which the series is based, and David E. Kelley, the creator of Ally McBeal and The Practice and Boston Legal, whose recent defection from broadcast to cable TV resulted in HBO's very well-received Big Little Lies. And the cast of Mr. Mercedes is loaded with very strong actors, too, from Mary Louise Parker and Kelly Lynch to the show's stars, Brendan Gleeson and Harry Treadaway. Stephen King, best known as an author of horror stories, often does his best when veering away from the supernatural, as in such movies and books as Stand By Me, Misery, and The Shawshank Redemption. Mr. Mercedes, at least as a standalone character study, is a similar departure. It's more of a detective story about a killer who uses his car as a murder weapon. And it's part Columbo because we know the identity of the mass murderer from the start. But it's also a cat-and-mouse chess game because the killer, after evading capture for years, begins taunting and haunting the now retired detective who failed to close the case. First, the killer sends a graphic email showing video of the crime scene, then leaves something on the detective's lawn. It's an escalating war, and after a couple of episodes, the detective agrees to actively engage. What makes this work across the board is the depth of character. In some Stephen King novels, characters can slip more into caricature or stereotype. But in this TV adaptation of Mr. Mercedes, time is taken so we get to know and care about almost everyone involved. That includes the victims, whom we get to know in what becomes an intensely frightening and unforgettable opening sequence. It definitely includes the retired detective, Bill Hodges, who is played by wonderful Irish actor Brendan Gleeson. Hodges now lives and hides in a suburban neighborhood, where his lawn has gone to seed, and so has he. He's a loner with a pet tortoise, which fits because Hodges has no intention of coming out of his shell either. Not even when his next-door neighbor, an attractive widow played by Holland Taylor, is uncomfortably frank and aggressive over dinner, on a number of levels.
When was the last time you had sex? Seriously.
You propositioned me, Ida.
Well, what if I am? You could do a lot worse.
Well, that's...
Not to mention, I live next door. There's something to be said for convenience.
You got it.
Hygiene as well. I'd need you to bathe. Do you?
Are you being serious here?
Face it, Bill. I'm your only option if you don't want to pay for it. But you're not an attractive man.
You're out of your mind.
Even the killer is a fully realized character. Played by Harry Treadaway, he's a computer whiz who works at an electronics store for a bullying boss and goes home to his locked workroom in the basement where he plans his crimes and carries out his acts of cyber terrorism. His mom, an alcoholic and incestuous hot mess played by Kelly Lynch, lives there too. And like the mother of Norman Bates in Psycho, she's part of the reason her son is as warped as he is.
You need a little fun in your life. That's all I'm saying, okay? Hey, why is it you never had a girlfriend? I just don't understand this. I mean, look, I'm not finding fault with you, honey, no. In fact, just the opposite. You're smart. You're resourceful. And you're good looking. Do you know how good looking you are? I would think the girls would drip off you.
Yeah.
gotta do work, so.
No, wait, wait. Give mommy a little kiss. Can you do that? Give me a little kiss first.
Mr. Mercedes, a 10-episode limited series, draws you in with these characters and conflicts and doesn't let go. David E. Kelley does a lot of the writing here himself, and other scripts are written by such strong writers as Dennis Lehane. The director is Jack Bender, who worked on both Game of Thrones and Lost. Together with King, this creative team makes the most of the freedom allowed by this new network platform, in terms of language, images, and even ideas. David Kelley and Stephen King have been entertaining the masses for many decades now. Yet in Mr. Mercedes, they're both doing some of their best work in years.
David Bianculli teaches TV and film at Rowan University and is the author of The Platinum Age of Television, From I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Dr. Jessica Nuttick-Zitter, a California physician who's grappling with how and when to implement her state's new End-of-Life Option Act, which allows certain terminally ill patients to receive medical assistance to hasten death. She's both a critical care and palliative care specialist who's often confronted with questions about when and whether to use invasive medical interventions with terminally ill patients. I hope you'll join us. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews, compare prices, and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com. And from the Herbert Simon Family Foundation, supporting NPR and member station WFYI in Indianapolis, working together to cover stories and issues that inform listeners in Indiana and beyond, by providing critical information about the factors influencing education.